The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, April 27th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. You want to know who has the most important job in the U.S. government? I actually don't know his name, but I know his job. It's the guy who oversees one aspect of this action that was undertaken yesterday.
The U.S. Air Force conducted a test of an intercontinental ballistic missile in California.
And here, mentioned as an almost afterthought, is the word that should calm you down a little bit.
Military officials say the unarmed missile launch demonstrates the United States' nuclear deterrent capability.
Unarmed. Whew. For all my life, if I heard a news item like that, I would assume the unarmed part. But these days, I want to hear unarmed right at the top. And not just because this administration seems a bit more likely to consciously forego the unarmed part, but also because this administration just might overlook the part where you take off the warhead. And that's the guy. That's the guy we need. The remove the warhead guy. And what if the remove the warhead guy, what if he's one of the thousands of unfilled positions in the federal government? Yeah, never got around to appointing the guy who takes off the warhead. But really, he is the most important, isn't he? Because, you know, if the guy who makes sure that the payload is nil, if that guy isn't employed, or if that guy got the wrong memo, or if that guy has a Steve Bannon level of follow through, or a Sebastian Gorka work ethic, we are all screwed. Well, not all of us, all of the Marshall Islands. That's where the missile landed. Although, you know, if it was an armed missile, I could see this administration successfully spinning that, right? Jeff Sessions goes out there, says, I told you about unelected judges on islands in the Pacific Ocean. Let this be a lesson to every island dweller in the Pacific Ocean. We can get to you. The administration will be really good at arguing they meant this all along. Kwajalein Lagoon. That's where all these missiles land. It's been called the world's largest catcher's mitt. Kwajalein Lagoon. Yeah, we totally meant to hit Kwajalein Lagoon. And I think they'd sell it. I think that maybe at worst, their polls would show that only 95% of those who voted for Trump would vote for him again, right? Down from the 96 that currently says they'd vote for him again. Who knows? Maybe if Rebecca Mercer had a series of vacation homes in the Marshall Islands or owned the Marshall Islands, it'd be a problem, but probably not. Believe me, no one is more pro Kwajalein Lagoon than me. Believe me. And I do believe him. And we should breathe a sigh of relief. Until 2 days from now, when we heard the ICBM headed for Kwajalein Lagoon was really headed for Australia. On the show today, two interviews, and one is a return of Vexillology Corner. All that fascinates in the world of flags. But first, you know about singer-songwriters, you know about actress-slash-models, sure. But what about talk show host-slash-game show host? Johnny Carson did it. He did it a few years apart. Pat Sajak did it, not very successfully, at least the talk show part. But now comedian Guy Branum tries it at the exact same time. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You got your studied erudition in my whimsical anecdote. No, you got your witty bon mot in my Rain Man-like recitation of fact. It's talk show game show. It's both a talk show and a game show.
We were in New Orleans shooting another movie called Girl Trip, starring Queen Latifah, Jada Pinkett Smith, Regina Hall, and myself, Tiffany Haddish.
Ah! Oh, wow. Pause break 2 points, a yellow card for excessive name dropping.
It's hosted by Guy Branum. It's on True TV. True TV, home of other shows like Impractical Jokers, Adam Ruins Everything, and Kansas State versus USC in the play-in round of the NCAA tournament. Hello, Guy. How are you?
Good to be here, Mike. Good to be here.
Was there a moment when you were watching what passes for talk shows these days where you said, that's it, this cannot stand, no more?
Frankly, it was just a slow process of all of the life being drained out of interviews. I feel like at some point in time in the late 90s, when I was watching like an Arnold Schwarzenegger or some other A-lister just go through the motions of a talk show, I just got pissed off because there was no life left. They were just like going through the pantomimes that publicists had planned for them, and there was nothing magical left. Like when you think about the magical days of this, like the Tonight Show in the 60s or 70s, when drunk people came on and told stories and admitted more than they should, and you legitimately felt like Johnny was having a good time. I missed that and wanted something of that back. So I built a show that forces people to be good and alive and on, or else they will be criticized on that same show.
It was the celebrity who was being contrived, who was not being asked to be witty, who was clearly, even though, of course, there was a promotional aspect to it back when Burt Reynolds and Don Rickles were cracking wise on Johnny's couch back when Johnny was wearing plaid. Sure, of course, there was transaction back then, but it was just the publicity industrial complex that got to you more than anything.
The thing is that I understand and respect the transactional aspect. Like, promoting your movie is what keeps the lights on. It's what keeps everything going. I just want to see you do it beautifully. Like, no one's saying that ice skaters shouldn't be on ice skates. We're just saying that they should do it well and make it feel flawless. I want to see people come on Talk Show the Game Show. You get points for plugging your projects and for name dropping your friends, but you have to do it in a way that is artful. You can't just go on and like slam your way through because it's part of the job. Look, if you want to just do your job, go sell insurance, go be a bricklayer. But if you're going to be an entertainer, entertain me, make me feel transported.
I want my Masons to be entertaining. I want all aspects of life to just have all the witticisms and the anecdotes and a funny thing happen to me on set.
Look, I have worked construction in my life, Mike, and most guys on a construction site are being way more interesting than a lot of people on talk shows today.
Yeah.
Like, the arrogance that it takes for these people who are paid millions of dollars to do almost nothing to go on and act like it is an indignity for them to go on a talk show and shill pisses me off to no end.
Yeah. Jorge Land Sheetrock, I mean, he's pretty good. He's better than Julia Stiles. I don't know if I'd put him in a class of Bradley Cooper, but, you know, he's getting up there.
But, Mike, the worst thing today is that we have all of these structures that are supposed to make it look like celebrities are witty and in the moment, like the exceedingly well-planned party games of of the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show, that are just disgusting. Like, a game of charades where everyone makes two wrong guesses and then a right guess is so produced and so gross. And it's like, why am I even watching this? And couldn't we for a moment have the risk of John Legend saying something stupid?
And it's not that Jimmy Fallon is a man without talent. It's like, I can't get out of my head, does the average person in Paducah know or care how contrived this is? It is kind of cute when some of the people do the version of karaoke where they do an impression of a singer. And sometimes you'll find that a singer that you liked can do an Ariana Grande impersonation. Fine. But it just become this cutesy, please like me moment that's so far apart from what a talk show could be. I'm not talking Terry Gross. I'm talking your ideal of a talk show, which is somewhat like my ideal of a talk show. Witty people saying witty, interesting things. It's not that anymore.
The thing is, the talent show aspect of it can be really, really fun and really, really cool. Ariana Grande's, like, capacity to do impressions of other singers was really fun to watch.
Yes.
The trouble is the point that you're making, that it's all about everybody being friends and holding hands, and there's no space for honesty in it. It all feels very, very fake. And I miss the little touch of Letterman, where there was a sense that if you don't bring it, you're gonna get a frown and some chilliness. And look, we're not here to frown. We're not here to be chilly. Talk Show the Game Show is about setting everybody up to do a great job. Like, we have Moby hunting tofu with a Nerf gun. Mm-hmm. That's good television.
When I watch actors or actresses that I like, who I like, on a talk show, and they're not good, I have trouble liking them again. And this also happens, I mean, it happened most starkly with, I think Ellen Page was hosting SNL. And so it's just not her, it's just not her thing. She never does live comedy. She was clearly reading the cue cards. And I went from loving Ellen Page to saying, I don't know, maybe I have to reconsider that roller derby movie after all.
I mean, for me, at the end of the day, it just comes down to feeling like this is somebody who is knowable and who you could be friends with and who does have some sense of savvy. You know, we all watch these people in TV and in movies or like on stage singing, and you know what they're good at. You know what their art is. A talk show should let you inside of them a little bit more. And when it's just a very, very planned game of Pictionary, I don't know that you're getting anything out of it.
Do you think that Carpool Karaoke is a great segment? It's just not a talk show segment?
Carpool Karaoke is amazing. I am better for having seen Adele talk about what the Spice Girls mean to her. I just think that talk shows used to be a place where comedians hosted a cocktail party every night. And now it is a place where guys who are good at singing have people over to sing. Like, it's not like there are that many comedians in late night anymore. It's a lot of affable guys. You know, James Corden hosts a great show, but he is a musical theater actor. Jimmy Fallon is supposed to be a comedian, but mostly what he does is laugh at other people's jokes and holds children's instruments. I expect nothing more from a talk show guest than I expect someone at my home for Passover, okay? If you show up, be ready to play.
Yeah. Okay, last question. Frigid Frida was so frigid, she wore a blank to bed. Let's see if we match.
Oh. I mean, look, my gut instinct is, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Ice Bucket. That's uh-huh. Terrible, though.
You could go with Ice Bucket. Maybe we'll match.
No. That's terrible. Now I'm being the housewife from Ventura.
Now McLean Stevenson is whacking you with his card.
Yes.
Now Jay Johnstone has thrown his hands up. Charles Nelson Reilly is like, is this guy on my team? What's going on?
She wears a stop sign to bed.
That's good. I had okay. Bear Trap, but that's good. That's
solid.
Good.
Solid. Yeah.
Guy Branum is the host of Talk Show Game Show. Check it out on True TV. It is a delight. It is charming. Thank you.
Thanks, bye.
Every day someone sends me a different proposed version of a new flag for a new city. And I swear to God, Tulsa, I'm going to get to you. There are so many city flags in so little time. But on this edition of Vexillology Corner, we have the fabrics of many a far-flung metropolis to parse. We even have an entire state where the lawmakers didn't realize they pulled a 180. So joining me now is Ted Kay, the former editor of The Raven, which is the journal of the North American Vexillological Society. And the author of Good Flag, Bad Flag. Thanks for joining us again, Ted.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
What's the trend in reviving, and it's a blessed trend, but what is the trend in, I should say, reforming city flags?
In 2004, our group, the North American Vexillological Association, did a survey
asking people to rate the design qualities of 150 American city flags and found that some were great and most were terrible in design. 11 years later, Roman Mars did a TED Talk about city flags, calling it "Why City Flags Are the Worst Design Things You've Never Noticed."
So when I moved back to San Francisco in 2008, I researched its flag because I had never seen it in the previous 8 years I lived there. And I found it, I am sorry to say, sadly lacking. I know. It hurts me too.
And he ended his TED Talk calling for people in cities with poor flags to try to get them redesigned. And he has launched a movement across the United States to redesign city flags. We're counting scores and scores of cities that are working on either adopting or updating their city flags.
So what cities are you working with?
Well, for example, recent ones that are just launching their efforts are Rochester, Minnesota, Orlando, Florida, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Columbia, South Carolina. Some that have successfully changed their flags, Provo, Utah, South Bend, Indiana, Sunnyvale, Texas, Aberdeen, Washington, and some that have launched great efforts but have stalled on political challenges, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Portland, Maine, Bellingham, Washington.
Provo. Take me through Provo's. That's an interesting change.
Provo was interesting on a couple levels because Provo had a flag that was rated in the worst 10 out of the 150 flags.
It was notorious. Yeah.
It just had Provo on and it had a rainbow-colored stripe underneath it. Provo had a local flag enthusiast, a vexillologist, or in the words of designing flags, a vexillographer, who proposed new flags for Provo, took them to city council, and a city council member who was actually a graphic designer proposed his own alternatives for Provo's city flag and then got the city council to adopt the new flag. So a city councilman himself, who was a graphic designer, created the flag for Provo. And then, unfortunately, the next year he died. And so that flag is, in a sense, a tribute to him.
Now, I will say something, and you do not have to comment. This is an editorial statement that in no way does Ted K endorse. But if you think a graphic designer on the city council will make a good flag, you probably think because Tom Price is a doctor, he'll have a good health care reform. Because I'm looking at the Provo flag, and it does have some merits. I enjoy its colors, which I don't normally see on a flag. And yet, I do not think that it passes your basic test of can a 10-year-old easily replicate it?
Yes. The proposals by the vexillographer in Provo, I would say, were superior to the flag that was eventually adopted in Provo, designed by the city council member. But that city council member's flag was head and shoulders above what Provo had before. So,
yes.
You know, they went from a 2 to a 7.
Mm-hmm.
They could have gone to a 9. It's a vast improvement to go from a 2 to a 7.
Yes, no longer appearing on the list of 10 worst. In fact, an above average flag. And I think I think it's important not to shame the municipality. They sometimes tend to get their backs up. Like, is that what's going on in Milwaukee? Is that why it stalled?
What happens in many places, states and cities, is if the public or experts say your flag's design doesn't quite measure up, they feel that they are being attacked personally, that somehow that's an attack on their city or on their state, when in fact it could well be just an objective measure saying your brand isn't doing what it could do for your city or state. But people get their backs up when their flags are criticized, even when, usually, those same people couldn't even describe the flag if you asked them about it.
that would be a good man on the street interview. Like, are you proud of your flag? And then you'd show it to them and it'd be a fake flag. And they'd say, we love that thing. Actually, yes. This is Provo's old flag. It clearly says Provo on it. Let's zoom out a little. We did city. Let's do state. In flag news, since we last talked, it was a big development. Nebraska flew its flag upside down at the Capitol for 10 days and nobody noticed. Now, my question to you is, does this in any way, like if Japan did it, no one would notice either. Does this mean that it's a flagging flag design?
Yes, Nebraska's flag is one of 24 U.S. states that have a seal on a blue background. We call those SOB flags, or seal on a bedsheet. And the problem with those flags is that you can't see the detail on the seal from a distance, so they all look very similar. Several states have tried to resolve that by writing the name of the state on the flag, like right. Montana or Kansas. It would be laughable if a nation wrote the name on the flag. Can you imagine writing France on the flag? We would just laugh at that. But somehow, we seem to think that it's okay to write the name of the state on the flag. I like to say, though, if you have to write the name of your place on your flag, then your symbolism has failed you. In Nebraska's case, Nebraska's flag is virtually indistinguishable at a distance anyway, so flying it upside down, you couldn't tell. And if it's hanging limp in some kind of government chambers, you're not going to notice anyway. Nebraska has the opportunity to adopt a great flag. Most of these states do, but the political inertia is a big challenge. People tend to like what they're used to, even though it's a bad flag.
Yeah. And Nebraska, I mean, they have the only state with a unicameral legislature. They can be rebels. They should, I say, break from the shackles of the old SOB flag. I've seen a few suggestions. They're fantastic.
Nebraska's got some great opportunities, although I would say many Nebraskans think that the flag of Nebraska is a big block N on a solid background.
Yes, it happens when the college football team so dominates the flag conversation.
My colleague in Kansas reminds me what the N on Nebraska football helmet stands for.
It's not Nebraska?
It stands for knowledge.
Oh, knowledge. This is classic Midwestern jibes. I love it. All right. Ted Kaye is the editor emeritus of The Raven. He is our friend in all matters vexillology. And he's the author of Good Flag, Bad Flag. Although it's not a shaming exercise. It's trying to pull all flags up by their bootstraps. Thank you, Ted.
Tremendous opportunities out there. Thanks for helping, Mike.
You got it. And now the spiel. Donald Trump seems to be a terrible college administrator, husband, Christian, purveyor of fine meats, student of geopolitics, ethicist. Yes, all true. But it has become increasingly clear that he is also terrible at something that his supporters give him credit for. Poker. Our president seems to be a terrible poker player. One old saying in poker is, weak hand, act strong. And that is a truism Trump seems to embody over and over again. He blusters constantly, but when it comes time to call or fold, he's always folding. Couple examples. During negotiations over health care, he told Republicans in the House, "That's it, take it or leave it, I'm done negotiating." They said, "Actually, we'd like some more changes." He said, "Fine, we could do some more changes." He told Democrats, "I just might withhold health care subsidies." And then he said, "I won't be withholding health care subsidies." Here's Homeland Security head John Kelly describing his boss's position with the wall.
He'll do the right thing for sure, but I will suspect he will be insistent on the funding.
He said, if you don't build the wall, we just might have to shut the government down. The Democrats said, we are not funding the wall. He said, that's fine. Whatever you do, don't shut the government down. And 2 days ago, he said he was going to pull out of NAFTA. And then yesterday, he said this.
I will hold on the termination. Let's see if we can make it a fair deal, because NAFTA has been a horrible deal for the United States.
So for all the tough tone, the message is mealy-mouthed. Okay, renegotiate. Whatever you do, don't withdraw. not withdrawing from NAFTA, by the way, is the better option, but it is another in a long string of examples where his bluster isn't backed up by action. Now, some have said, you know what he's doing the whole time? He's bluffing. A member of the Mexican Senate told the Times, it seems like he's sitting at a poker table bluffing rather than making serious decisions. In front of a bluffer, you always have to maintain a firm and dignified position. But in poker, bluffing is a serious decision, and it's not necessarily a bad decision, but there are a couple of things that you have to do to make it work. First of all, you have to be tactical. You can't do it all the time. If you do it all the time, you may fool some minnows, but experienced players will wait you out, wait till they have stronger cards, call you, and then you're busted. Also, you must show that you actually do have strong hands from time to time. So acting tough when you're clearly in a weak position, like when he was trying to twist the arms of the Republican Congress, who clearly saw how unpopular the health care bill was going to be, that's just playing a losing hand. Often Trump doesn't bluff, he just blusters. So in poker, this would be called table talk, right? Some guy starts saying, oh, what a good hand, oh, what good cards, right? He's not betting, he's just talking up his hand, which you really shouldn't do, but sometimes it's allowed. He announces how confident he is in his hand. Then when it does come time to bet, he doesn't even put any chips in. Trump has also pulled the idiotic move of passively calling everyone else and then meekly folding when he could pressure an adversary if he had the guts. He seems much less interested in even pretending that he was going to risk a government shutdown than he was in receiving any criticism from the failing media and fake news who are ready to issue report cards on his 100th day. By the way, his 100th day would be the very same day that a shutdown would occur. And he wanted no part of that. And that was clear. And everyone knew it. If you don't play poker, you probably think bluffing is the same as lying. But it's not. It's more complex than that. And Trump is a liar, but he is not a complex liar. And there have been showdowns that Trump has won, but I really have not seen an instance where he got the better of an adversary in a deal when he had the worse hand. There have been times when Trump held a big hand in his small hands, like when he got New York City to close a ramp on the West Side Highway to accommodate his apartment building. He did win that fight. The city thought 4 cars a minute, that's how many use the ramp in rush hour, wasn't worth keeping his stalled real estate project in limbo indefinitely. He won that fight, but it was in a big position to win. I've never seen him pull off an upset. Trump probably thinks that he's a successful bluffer because he knows himself to be a successful con artist. But con artistry is different from bluffing. Con artistry is when the game is rigged. And when the game is rigged, you're not playing poker. Trump has worked the system. He has, say, refused to pay contractors. That's not bluffing. That's like buying chips on an IOU then skipping out on your debt. The world of poker looks less favorably on that than the world of business, by the way. Trump is simply a cartoon version of the loudmouth at the table who gets called on the river and then limps away. He's as much a poker player as he is a statesman or a philanthropist. Anyway, like they say, the only way to make money in a casino is to own one. Except for Trump. He owned a casino and he lost at that, too. And that's it for today's show. Just producer Chris Berube is now hosting a cooking show / makeover show where farm fresh ingredients and flash frying turn an ugly duckling into a succulent, albeit bony swan. Mary Wilson, just producer, is developing a cop show / dating show where the broken windows theory tries to mend broken hearts. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of the Panoply Network, is introducing a nature show / housewife show where Sir Richard Attenborough explains the mating rituals and predatory instincts of suburbanites with too much Botox. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, is hosting a Jackass show / Sunday talk show. Don't have to really change much, just the title, Faceplant the Nation. The gist, we're combining an upcoming C-SPAN hearing with softcore porn, Mike Flinimax. Oom Peru, Dat Peru, Do Peru, and thanks for listening.